concludes our series relating to astral theology. And we hope that a few points have been made with sufficient clarity to suggest that the subject offers a key to the interpretation of ancient lore, and at the same time reminds us that the principles and values involved in the teaching are as valid today as they were thousands of years ago. Regardless of the times in which we live, the journey of the human soul remains the most important consideration in the life of the individual and should be one of the great dynamics of the life of the collective. Until the human being senses again his citizenship in space, until he realizes that his destiny is not fulfilled in the small cycle of immediate experiences with which he is familiar, we cannot hope to develop a long-range perspective capable of impelling us or inspiring us to a course of constructive conduct. The individual today has lost his kinship with a group of values which ancient man fully appreciated and accepted. He saw himself as part of a vast living organism. He sensed that all of space was populated with rational creatures, beings whose lives and thoughts might be infinitely beyond the comprehension of man. Yet these beings existed, and their thoughts and lives were valid experiences in nature. Old-time scholarship sought to adjust man to the universe, whereas the modern thinker seeks to adjust the universe to man. This is not reasonable nor essentially possible, because man is not the axis of the vast plan which moves around us. Man is part of that plan, but the plan has its own destiny. Man is involved in that destiny, but he cannot control it, nor is he the principal factor in the purpose of existence itself. Thus, by a proper modesty, by a gentle humility, by a recognition of the importance and dignity of the human estate, without exaggeration or distortion, we achieve something that is important. In religion and philosophy, particularly in recent centuries, man has become too important. He has become important in a self-centered way. He has become too egotistically significant. And in the emphasis upon himself, he has failed to emphasize his relationships with the larger world of which he is a part. Until he has proper perspective, he cannot cooperate adequately with any purpose greater than his own personal interest. Now today, even, we recognize larger purposes. We recognize such desirable ends as world peace. We hope to see ultimately the end of poverty. We would like to see universal enlightenment. We would like to have a factual statement of human equality. We look for the time when prejudice and intolerance will cease, and that the individual will live in a better kind of world. He cannot attain these ends, however, unless he becomes conscious of the machinery of progress, and unless he becomes willing to adjust his own personal desires with those larger emotions by means of which collective goods of one kind or another can be recognized. realized, attained. The ancient man, therefore, looking around and seeing the universe, saw it as a vast house. He saw it as a house in which there were many rooms, many departments. He also recognized life unfolding in this great structure as being composed of innumerable parts, no part actually more important than another. Some parts more advanced in their present growth, some more humble, some lives rudimentary, others apparently approaching the completion of their spans of growth. But these various differences were quantitative rather than qualitative. An ancient man recognized a common life which he had to respect, which he sought to understand, and which he did not wish to violate. We say, for example, that ancient man, when he hunted for food, he killed animals. But he killed them to live himself. He killed them to feed the hungry. Ancient man never killed for sport. He never killed for the joy of destroying. Ancient man also never built merely in order that he might create with his hands. He built with a dedicated purpose. The things that he did, he sought to make important through the help of his gods, through the dedication to his religion, to his faith. His every art and science was dedicated. His own life was dedicated. We may wonder then how it happens that so dedicated a people did not attain the end which they desired. That is, that they were not able, through dedication alone, to achieve the securities that we still seek. One of the reasons, perhaps, why they were unable to succeed totally was that, like all of us, they were in processes of growth. Even today, there is no such a thing as total achievement. An achievement is as of now. But the individual who attains the fullness of today will be deficient in the things of tomorrow. Progress goes on. The individual cannot, from the imperfect level of his own realizations, achieve to ultimates. He must grow and build and restore and repair. He must go on struggling towards the greater goal, which can only come through the greater unfoldment of himself. So our forebears long ago on the plains of Babylonia or Syria, or in some ancient mountain fastness of northern Asia, looking out upon the universe, experienced first of all kinship. The universe was not strange. It was near. It was not terrible. It was tremendous, but not fear-inspiring. It was vast, but this very vastness challenged man to grow rather than to surround him with fear. And so enlightened peoples began to reach out in friendliness to the stars. They did not populate the firmament with evil beings, but with great good powers. And they sensed these good powers as forever protective and paternal. They sensed these powers as contributing continuously to the well-being of every creature that existed. And by the time Egyptian civilization had arisen, we see this universe in which we live strangely charted, mysteriously organized into planes and levels and spheres and departments. There were worlds within worlds, wheels within wheels, as in the story of Ezekiel's vision. Man saw the universe as a vast structure of evolving life and saw himself moving through this structure. One of the most difficult problems he had to face in his ancient seeking was the fulfillment of his yearning to share with life, to share with the total experience of existence. This perhaps was the beginning of mysticism. Certainly it was the beginning of man's seeking, when man went forth alone into the night to fast and to pray and to meditate, to ask the presence or ask awareness of the powers which he felt were around him and within him. Primitive man did not believe that all his deities were far above the sky. They lived in the earth and in the rocks around him. They lived in the mountains and the valleys and the trees and the waterfalls. He had this wonderful sense of the nearness of the creative agencies. We've lost this because man finds nearness only to his own kind or to the strange, complicated world which he himself has fashioned. As a result of this lack of nearness to large things, this lack of ability to go out and simply contemplate and feel, man has become a highly neurotic creature. Some psychologists like to tell us that ancient man was also neurotic. He probably was to a degree. But had he been as neurotic as we are, it is questionable if the race could have survived. Actually, he had, as a medicine for his neurosis, so many beautiful things that we no longer have. Perhaps they were superstitions. Perhaps we feel that we have outgrown them, like the fairy tales of childhood. But whatever it is, we have lost the beautiful. We've lost the sublimity of life and have locked ourselves in a world of routine patterns, of mediocrities, which neither satisfy the imagination nor nourish the idealism in our constitutions. How we shall understand this pattern in terms of astral theology will require a little understanding of ancient man's opinions and beliefs. Where did man come from? Well, theologies tell us and philosophies imply that man came out of a universal state. Like the old poem, he came from the everywhere into the here. The ancient man believed that in a remote period, men lived with the gods, that men were fashioned first in a strange heavenly state, that man had in his constitution something of the divine nature, that he dwelt above the world in a mysterious abode of blessedness. And then he started forth on his journey. And the story of his journey is very much the story of the prodigal son. Man's beginnings in the great cycle of existence have been variously explained. The Egyptians and the Greeks were of the opinion that man primarily sought experience consciously and willingly. These peoples did not have a fall in their theology, as some other nations had, this concept of man being driven out of paradise. Many ancient peoples and most Eastern peoples did not feel that this was true. Man was not an involuntary exile, nor was he punished for original sin. Man went forth as an adventurer. He went forth to conquer the unknown because such is the nature of man. Such is the nature of life. The American Indian will tell you that just as the young man, reaching maturity, feels his own individuality and wants to go forth upon the adventure of life to create a new home, to bring a new world into being, so primordial man, primitive man, in the presence of the gods, is said to have looked forth into the great expanse and mystery of creation and decided to go adventuring. He wanted to know what was beyond and below and around him. He wanted the victory that comes from effort, from victory over limitation. Here again we have the story of the prodigal son, because there was one son who stayed home, and the son or sons who remained at home took care of their father's house, were good and obedient children. And yet one went forth as a prodigal and wasted his substance in riotous living. He went down into Egypt, and he passed through great catastrophe and great sorrow. And finally he returned to his father's house, in this case as a penitent, as a repentant one. And the father was so happy that the return of his son that he caused the fatted calf to be slain to form a banquet. And when the other sons said, why should the one who has sinned be given all this attention, and we who have been good have had no attention? The father, in rapturous emotion, exclaimed, but this son was lost, and he is found again. He has been taken from us, and he has returned to us, and greater is the rejoicing because he has come back. The ancients built on that theme somewhat, with other modifications. They held that there was something more important than being happy forever. And this more important thing was to go forth and learn. And behind man's great cycle of progress and growth was not the arbitrary bolt of lightning or the flaming sword, but man's instinctive and native desire to go forth and learn. We are all learners. We are all seekers. Life is a questing after value. Life is a release into manifestation of potential strength and power. Life is man gradually gaining victory over ignorance and death and darkness. Life is a kind of game, a sublime divine game. And in this spirit, ancient man faced it. He faced it as he faced the day, fully recognizing its hazards and its dangers, but also realizing that every hazard was a potential victory. Every danger was an opportunity to be greater than circumstance. These thoughts then, according to ancient doctrine, sent man into the great mystery of the world, sent him forth out of the state of innocence into the search for virtue, out of ignorance into the questing of wisdom, and out of a static potential into a sphere of dynamic potency which he had to conquer. So man is out conquering. He has gone forth upon the mystery of self-knowing, of understanding, of gaining all the strength in himself. Therefore, according to the scripture, he will in the fullness of time be greater than the angels. Because the angels did not go forth in this great search for self-knowing and self-becoming. But in the old ways, these various steps that were taken were not regarded as we regard them, as stupendous episodes, as great problems to be greatly considered, any more than the growth of the child was a great problem. It was taught that the child was going to grow up and be a child no more. That sometime maturity would take the place of childishness, and all growth and education and preparation were toward maturity, toward self-integration, towards complete personal acceptance of the burden of individual existence. These things were behind the Greek legends and the Hindu and Chinese legends. And so man stepped out of the mystery of the heavens into the strange circles of the spheres. He began to experiment with the problem of life existence in itself. And the first thing he had to do before he could function in any sphere or any world, he had to fashion for himself some kind of a body in that world. He could not move from one state of matter to another or from one state of energy to another unless he had an instrument within himself by which he could be attuned and adjusted with the new state into which he was passing. The old philosophies tell us that when man moved downward out of his original state, he did not cast off his divinity. He simply enclosed it in a lesser condition. He put on new vestments, but the same spiritual being was within them. As man lost his contact with the heaven world, it was not because the God in him died, or that the God in him departed, but rather that it was vestured with a heavier raiment. And this raiment was derived, as the Hermetic axioms tell us, by descending through the various parts of the world. Thus in the Pymander of Hermes, we see the soul coming down through the orbits of the seven planets, or the five planets and the luminaries. And as the soul entered into the state of each of these planetary cycles, the god or the keeper of the planet bestowed something upon the soul. And Saturn bestowed upon the soul prudence and gravity, but it also supplied a kind of veil or vestment which locked the consciousness, the pure spiritual life, within a garment of prudence, within a structure of abstract mind. And this structure was embryonic, it was unborn, it was untried and untested. It wrapped the individual in a potential. And as man descended into the great ring of Saturn, according to the ancients, he received the potential of abstract mind, the power to become prudent. He did not become prudent. He merely gained the power to be. And as he descended beyond this into the sphere of Jupiter, another vestment was added over as a garment upon an undergarment. And man gained the potential power of being reasonable, the power to rationalize, the power to think things through, to philosophize, to idealize facts, and to gain the actual attribute of judgment. Then he went still further down and he received another vestment over the ones that he had already gained. And this third vestment was bestowed by the spirit of Mars. And this was the vestment of courage. The individual gained the power to become brave, to have patience, perseverance, to stand under the struggle and stress of things, to bear pain, to bear reverse with fortitude, to have the courage to dare, added to the wisdom to be silent, which he had previously received. Then he went still further, and another luminous vestment was imposed upon him, and he was surrounded with a halo of light. And in this next, or in the great solar arc, he gained for himself the power of vitality, the power of energy, courage, and to be sustained and supported by energy. Without energy, man's courage remains locked hopelessly within himself. Energy becomes necessary to courage. But he gained this mysterious thing that is said in the Bible. The breath of life was breathed into him, and he became a living thing, a living being. And his life came from the sun. And his life made him a dynamic creature, rather than merely the patient bearer of ancient mysteries. And from the sun he passed on downward still further. And he received from the guardian of the gate of Venus, he gained the mysterious power of beauty. He gained the ability to love, the ability to sacrifice with great tenderness of affection, the strange and wonderful ability to forget self in the service of the beloved. And this vestment of love was placed upon him, not as a mature instinct, but merely as a garment. And then he went still further downward into the mystery of things, and he came to the orbit of Mercury. And here was given to him skill and cunning, and the ability to use his hands, and to fashion and to fabricate things. And he was also given quickness, and according to the Greeks, wit was bestowed, so that he might bear the rest with patience. Without a certain wit, without a certain humor in his own consciousness, without a lightness from somewhere, all these problems and burdens might be too heavy for him. And then he came down into the orbit of the moon, and here imagination was bestowed. And imagination was the power that was sometime to break all the bounds and boundaries that held him, and to give him freedom and release into a larger life. And thus well covered with seven raiments, one within another, until he was burdened and loaded and heavy with garments, and was now obscured so that he could no longer function easily or even be aware of his ancient birthright of freedom and airiness and liberty. He was then, according to the Greeks, caused to fall downward into darkness, into the mystery of the sphere of generation, which is the earth. And here then he was born with the seven vestments within himself, hidden from all sight, contained within and behind this thing which we call the body. And having entered into the sphere of generation, he became mindful of the gifts that had been given to him. He felt them moving through himself. He did not understand them, but each of these vestments was a power of his soul, a power of consciousness within him, an attribute, an aspect, an adornment given to the soul by the stars in order that the soul might find its way back home again. And so in birth, man, heavy with the gifts of the gods, which had become a darkness upon him, a burden rather than a release, was carried by the very weight of these divine gifts into the sleep of spiritual death, which we call physical awaking. And then begins the great problem of growth. Each child, growing from infancy to maturity, passes gradually through unfoldments, and these unfoldments are the releasings of the potentials of the soul. One by one, the locked attributes, the vestments given by the gods and planets, begin to become active through the manifestation of the individual. And little by little, he comes into possession of the seven powers of the planets in his daily life. He does not know exactly what these powers are, and most of all, he does not realize that in a strange way, these powers are all restrictions upon himself, because his pure consciousness has been continuously restricted, and what we call the gifts of the planets are actually limitations imposed upon us by these conditioned psychic pressures and factors. Thus man, adorned with all these benefits, is really the victim of his own adornment. He is less than he was in the beginning because he is no longer free to express his natural consciousness. So he goes from the cradle to the grave, and in the course of life he learns to use these various attributes which he possesses on the physical level of life. He gains skill in judgment in some cases, or he becomes prudent, or his courage is sufficient, or his skill is great, or his imagination is strong. His affections may be ardent, and his vitality may blaze forth in the number and multitude of his achievements. But all of these things represent only physical expressions of these attributes. The mysterious vestments, the gifts of the gods, are still locked within him. Now the ancients said that just as surely as man in the course of life unfolds certain potentials and uses them for the development of his orientation here, just as surely as he can only attain here by bringing into manifestation things locked within himself, so man gradually becomes crystallized by what we call old age. Little by little, these potentials and powers which he has close in upon him again. His prudence becomes overcaution and finally fearfulness. His judgment becomes locked by crystallization into intolerance, into opinion, or perhaps is not well enough developed to give him the power to judge righteous judgment. His courage leads him to disaster. He becomes not brave but audacious, and in such allows his ambitions to pervert his principles. His energy he wastes, as the prodigal son did, in riotous living. We waste our energies, and then sometime wish we had them. Love leads him to innumerable tangles, disconcerting circumstances. He feels that his love is wasted, or that it is betrayed, or he does not develop it strongly enough to have a constructive and creative impulse there. The love of beauty and truth are ignored, and the individual falls merely into the lower victimizings of the sensory perceptions. Wit, skill, produce not only the cynic and the skeptic, but skill without understanding gives us a scientific world which is not safe to live in. Imagination leads us into every fantasy and excess, into suspicion, into tyranny, despotism, into all kinds of terror in the night. So one by one, these powers of the soul, which should be blessed, which should give us the full measure of realization, betray us and leave us victim to the excesses which their perversions indicate. Such was the state of man when the ancients conceived the idea of creating the great ladder of the mysteries. This great method of release, not release for this life alone, not release merely for years or for days, but the recognition that what we call evolution is man's victory over all the limitations imposed by conditions upon the unconditioned consciousness within himself. So a great symbolical pattern was created which reversed the involutionary procedure. Man gratefully and gladly returned to each of the guardians of the spheres the gifts which they had bestowed. He outgrew these gifts. He rose above them. He transmuted and transformed them and handed back the vestments and the adornments which they represented. There are ancient fables in the East about this, the fables of the king who so adorned himself with his jewels and with his wealth and with all the symbols of his honors and dignities that when he fell into a river he drowned because of the weight of his adornments. And this is what happens to man. Because of the weight of his adornments, he falls into generation and drowns in matter, becoming what we call a materialist or an unenlightened person. But the rescuing of this was by the long process of outgrowing conditioned existence. And to achieve this end, the soul had to consciously ascend through the seven orbits of the stars, ascending as a star, the goddess, ascended from the dark threshold of the moon god up through the seven gates to the upper world from which she had come. The journey back upward, like the mysterious story of Dante being led by Beatrice from the Purgatorio into the Paradiso, is always man's eternal psychic entity leading him back by his dreams, his aspirations, and his affections to the great spheres from which he fell, or from which he descended, not by a moral fall, but by determination or decision to seek adventure, to seek things, and in gaining things, to lose self. This is also the burden of Buddhism, that man, gaining all other things, has as a result lost pure consciousness, without which his journey to light cannot be perfected. In astral theology, then, the soul first sought to escape from generation, sought to escape from the mystery of death, or perhaps to escape by death from the mystery of this world, to come back to a state in which there was no longer any worldliness in him, to draw him back again into material existence. To escape from the world, he must therefore escape from worldliness. And what were the great pressures of worldliness, which had to either be overcome or man would be drawn back? In fact, he could never escape. Death was only an exchange from the visible to the invisible side of nature. Man never actually transcended the great material sphere of things, either in life or in death. He merely disappeared and appeared again by the ancient concept of rebirth. He was never away from worldliness until worldliness ceased within himself. Religion held this to be true, and most of your mystical theologies were derived from the ancient astrotheological symbolism of the soul beginning its journey upward by its effort to overcome the world. This is another meaning, of course, of the dragon slave. The individual overcoming monsters, the knight errant going forth and rescuing the fair maiden by killing the wicked ogre or the giant or the monster which had this maiden captured in his castle. The maiden, of course, is the psychic self, which must be rescued by the determination of the individual to overcome the giant of mortality or of materiality. And there is no way in which we can conquer the world. Perhaps there was a perverse psychology behind all this great belief that man could escape the world by conquering it. Perhaps the reason why we have had Genghis Khans and Hitlers and Alexanders and Caesars, Mussolinis and Stalins, is because the human soul has misread an archetypal symbolism. Man has sensed that he had to overcome the world. But because perhaps his own enlightenment was not great enough, he thought he could free himself from it by becoming master over it. He thought he could finally reach that condition in which he was free because he was a law unto himself. When he reached that security, when he bound the whole world in slavery to his purpose, then no one could contradict him, no one could deny him, no one could refuse him, no one could thwart him. Then he thought, I am free. But he never found that to be true. He found with Wolfe at the time of the Battle of Quebec, he found that the path of glory leads but to the grave. He discovered finally that he could not escape the world by conquering it, that he could never reach a condition of security so complete that he was free from the world. Therefore, he turned, as the mystic turned, to another method. Instead of attempting to conquer the world, he attempted to conquer worldliness in himself, realizing that he was bound here by these very ambitions which he sought to satisfy or to gratify. Consequently, by becoming desireless, by no longer responding to the allurements of the world, by no longer admitting the power of the world, he could perhaps escape from its tremendous, insidious effect upon himself. Ancient man then really believed that he had to be born again out of this world, if possible, born without death. That instead of dying out of a material state, he must die out of the materiality in himself. This was the second birth. This was the twice-born one who had achieved conscious liberation during life. It was a birth into a new state in which the Greeks said the hero dwelt, the hero being the person who had overcome the world as an experience of consciousness, was therefore free from it, because it could no longer be stimulated in himself. He would no longer hate. He would no longer desire. He would no longer sacrifice his principles for his possessions. He gained a certain detachment. How did he do it? Usually by becoming internally conscious in some way of something superior to the world. He could not escape while he believed in the world. But if by mystical experience or by the strange disciplines of ancient esoteric sciences and philosophies, he was able to experience inwardly a freedom from this world and realize that in departing from it as an experience of consciousness, he was not leaving the greater for the lesser or the known for the unknown, but rather that he was leaving something that he had outgrown, leaving darkness for light, leaving things that are not true for things that are, gaining more than he could possibly lose, finding himself by sacrificing that which was not his real self. Buddhism taught this in renunciation, that the individual, through inward discipline, gradually relaxed away from the world. And having done so, he passed through the first gate of the mysteries and was, for the beginning of his journey, a free soul, a soul-searching light. And beyond this, he then had to pass through what the ancient Indians might have called the yogas. He had to pass through the levels of the planets, and he had to return to each one of these planets the garment or gift which each had bestowed to him. And the only way he could return any of these garments was to outgrow them. He could not cast them off. He had to achieve a victory over them. He had to make himself greater than they were. He had to exhaust their usefulness and their ability to hurt him. He could only, therefore, go on when he had achieved complete mastery over the mystery that was represented for the planetary gift. So when he came to the orbit of the moon on his return journey, he had to transform the potential of imagination into the full release from it, the full expression of it. He had used imagination first unwisely, then wisely, and finally he had reached a point where imagination was no longer important, where the individual exchanged his imaginings for the facts which he had discovered for the growth of his own consciousness. Man does not have to imagine the wonders of the world if he understands the world. The world is in fact more wonderful than any dream that he could have. And through true and complete understanding, the distortions, the imageries, and the fantasies of things were no longer vital to him, no longer necessary to give him inspiration or impulse. Let us say, for example, that a person is inspired to do a good deed. He may be inspired by hope, or by faith, or by charity. He may imagine all the wonderful outcome that will follow this good deed, and therefore he is strengthened to do it. But when he is wiser, he will do that good deed without any of these overtones at all, simply because a certain action is lawful, right, proper, necessary, and the only thing conceivable. When he reaches this point, he can return the cloak of imagination to the lunar guardian who keeps it. He no longer needs it. He is not deficient in anything that imagination stands for, but he has released consciousness from imagination and into fact, and the fact is more beautiful, more wonderful, and more true than anything that he could imagine. Then he goes onward to the problem of skill and to this little humor problem that we described. He must return to Mercury the gifts which this orbit has given to him. And so we find that he returns to this level, that level of his mentality, which has to do with proficiencies of all kinds. He returns the powers which Mercury has, among them the arts and sciences, because these arts and sciences were all schoolrooms in which he studied, and having mastered the lesson, he no longer needs them. Having transcended sensory perceptions, he is no longer dependent upon them. He moves inward into the archetypal soul powers by means of which he can direct his higher destiny. So he returns to Mercury these problems. And he also returns this element of humor. For this humor is no longer necessary to the individual who values things correctly. Because the moment he values them correctly, they are sufficiently satisfying and sufficiently optimistic so that the truth is more joyous than any interpretation or any jest that we can create about it. And he returns in due force and time the emotion of love and beauty to the keeper of the orbit of Venus, because he has now discovered a transformation of emotion within himself. He is no longer subject to profane affection. He has rather transformed all personal emotion into compassion, or the great spiritual attribute of love. He has gained a soul power, and it is no longer necessary for him to use the instruments of trial and error which he previously knew. He then ascends to the sphere of the sun, and here he returns his energy, because he no longer needs to do as Satan does, rush up and down the world. He no longer needs activity as we know it,
because the greater activity is a psychical quality within himself, beyond dimension. Vitality is no longer necessary. In its place is a simple directive. He is no longer burdened with bodybuilding or the need of energies and vitamins to maintain himself. All these things are necessary because of his own ignorance, and as he becomes wiser, he outgrows them. He then returns also his courage to the orbit of Mars, because courage is only necessary in the presence of the unknown. When the individual recognizes the immutability of good, he needs no courage, for he knows there can be no evil thing happen to him. And he returns to the sphere of Jupiter, the judgment which it bestowed. And last of all, he returns to Saturn, its prudence. And then, as the wonderful golden verse of Pythagoras says, the soul, freed from all these bonds and all these burdens and all these raiments, rises in its own pure nakedness to return again to the world of light from which it came. It has, however, passed through a strange experience, a strange transformation, because in the Greek philosophy, the soul that descended in the childish ignorance of the unknown around it and within it. But the soul ascending has ascended by conscious, intentional victory, step by step. So the innocent, childish soul that descended gives place to the strong, mature, virtuous soul that has decided all things and has chosen to cling unto that which is good. Thus the journey of the soul through the spheres gives man the power of decision. It gives him the right to choose to be right. And as a result of that, it gives him good destiny. It gives him the right to earn a destiny, which cannot be earned unless all factors composing it are voluntary decisions of his own. The gods could preserve man in innocence, but only man himself, given the opportunity to do both right and wrong, can achieve to the state of virtue, which is the determination to cling to that which is right. So this journey was a kind of initiation, and all your initiation rites and ceremonies of ancient man were based upon this story, based upon man gradually achieving victory over the seven parts of his own soul, restoring their attributes to the universe from which they came, and resurrecting victoriously from the sevenfold body or psychic entity which contained and locked him within itself. Now in China we have another interesting simile, which was also well known to the ancients. Namely, every time at the service of the fortunate New Year, during the great period of the Manchurian emperors, the streets of the Forbidden City, the great wonderful road of state in Peking, were strewn with the sand of Gobi to connect the imperial city, the vermilion city of the emperor, with the temple of heaven of the fortunate New Year. And here, in simple white robe, on the day of the ceremony, the emperor, alone and unattended, walked the yellow sand of Gobi from the imperial palace to the altar of heaven. And here, before heaven, he made his offerings. Here he offered himself as the living sacrifice for the well-being of his people. And in this ceremony, it was said that he followed the will or dictates of the ancient emperor Shang Ti, imperial heaven. For this emperor, who was more or less the golden emperor of the sun, walked the wonderful gold sand, the strewn band of the zodiac, and the great annual journey to the feast of the fortunate New Year was part of the astronomical mystery in ancient China. We've already mentioned the perilous journey of the sun through the signs of the zodiac. Among the Greeks and Persians particularly, this perilous journey was again revived in connection with the human soul. The soul or psychic self was therefore regarded as performing 12 labors. A man in his journey through the great spiritual year of his destiny, the year composed of the length of time that took him to move from ignorance to wisdom, from mortality to immortality, accomplished this by means of 12 labors. And these were the labors of Hercules, and they were also the mysterious voyages of Sindbad the sailor, and they are contained very beautifully concealed, but quite clearly stated, in the Odyssey of Homer. These legends and fables were all derived from the mystery rituals. In the Egyptian rites, there were 12 deities, 12 ancient gods who sat in judgment. These 12 gods passed upon the virtues and vices of the human soul. They were the testers, the triers, the guardians, and only those who could pass successfully the examinations given by the 12 gods of the old road were permitted to pass on into the blessedness. Now these 12 gods or guardians of the old road, of course, relate to the solar mystery. And as man became a little more sophisticated in his astronomy and a little more aware of the mystery of the year, he likened his own spiritual cycle of life to this story of the annual journey of the sun. So man started out with the firm conviction that this mystery revealed to him the things he had to do. For the old question is asked again and again, what must a man do that he shall be saved? And this problem of being saved to the ancient meant that he must be worthy. Salvation comes from the same word as salary. That is, we are paid a salary. A salary to the Romans, as the word salary implies, was a payment in salt, because the Roman soldier was paid in salt, a very valuable and important and useful commodity. And the payment that he received in salt was called his salary. Now, salvation comes from the same thing. It means well salted. And it also means that those who are saved are the salt of the earth. Because salt is also the most ancient thing for the preserving of food. When they didn't know what to do with it, they put it in brine. And by putting it in brine, they could keep it indefinitely. So salvation meant to be kept in salt. Now, we have hardly that idea of it anymore, but it has its useful points. Because if the salt shall lose its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? And in the scriptures we hear a great deal about it. Now, in the ancient days of royalties, particularly in England, they had a very large salt cellar. It was a symbolic one that looked more like the trophy that you win when you do a particularly good round of golf or something of that nature, a trophy cup. The great salt might be 2 feet high, and it was placed on the baronial table. That is, it was placed on the table of the nobleman, dividing those who sat above the salt and those that sat below the salt. And great people sat above the salt, and common humble people sat below the salt. And the interesting point was that the sign of poverty was that you did not have enough salt. The salt was a luxury at one time that belonged very definitely to the great and the privileged. And those that were above the salt were supposedly the salt of the earth, although from what we can learn in English history, it wasn't always quite literally true. But here we come to this point. What must a man be do to be saved? Salvation had to do with preservation. And preservation had to do with man performing certain dangerous tasks and surviving wonderfully these hazards and these tests. And in order to achieve these ends, he had to show his courage. And in your Greek legends of Hercules, you see that for various reasons, usually to satisfy some deity, the hero had to perform some peculiarly hazardous and dangerous undertaking, presumably beyond mortal accomplishment. Well, this problem is is quite obvious. The attainment of even a reasonably enlightened standard of living is almost beyond human accomplishment. It is little short of a magnificent example of heroics of some kind. We do not see the swords flashing or the helms with their brilliant plumage. We do not hear the crash of battle, but every achievement that we make is a struggle against pressures, struggle against a many-headed hydra, where as we lop off one bad habit, seven more grow from the blood. Everything we try to do confronts us with mythological situations, just as remarkable and dramatic as those in our ancient fairy lore. For all folklore deals with archetypal symbols, symbols of man's struggle for security. So in the ancient Greek and Persian rites, in the temples, the band of the zodiac was stretched across the sky. Sometimes it was made into the mosaic floor. Very often it was traced upon the robes of priests and upon the garments worn by neophytes. Apuleius wore the star-spangled cloak when he went in to the mysteries. These stories had to do with the journey, the perilous journey of the soul through the 12 tasks that had to be performed before a man can be saved. And these 12 were represented by the zoons, or the animals of the zodiac. And these animals, in turn, were each of them an emblem of some ancient law or principle, a hieroglyph signifying a positive and negative attribute. Each one of these creatures was either a constructive or a destructive force. Each one had its privation and its success, and it also had its moderation. The work of the hero was to pass the test without, in his own turn, violating a principle. If he violated one law in order to keep another, he became hopelessly involved in a labyrinth. The great trick was not to win primarily. The great achievement was to win without having done anything that would cause a loss. In other words, you could always slay your enemy, but how to overcome him without hurting him was more difficult. You could always be angry at evil and oppose it, but how to oppose it without being evil yourself, that was more difficult. How to end sequences of causations without setting new ones in motion doing it. How to so conduct oneself that the correction of one evil did not engender 10 more. How to solve the mystery of the Medusa.